An Evening of Mystery Authors, Aunt Agatha's Mystery Bookstore celebrates 25 years with authors William Kent Kruger and Julia Keller.
Welcome. I'm just so excited to be here and to see so many people here that I know. I think I know just about everyone in this room, and it's just really wonderful. We cannot believe we've been open for 25 years, and I want to just quickly introduce my husband, Jamie, who's in the back there, because he's like the best book guy ever. And he is just so good at matching any reader with the right book. But two of the reasons we love what we do are sitting next to me tonight. These are two of my very favorite writers, and I'm just so happy to have shared them with a lot of you in the audience. William Kent Kruger hardly needs an introduction. He's the author of the Cork O'Connor Mysteries, as well as his standalone novel and Edgar winner, Ordinary Grace, which many of you have mentioned already tonight. It won every mystery award the year it was published, as it should have. His Cork books have been honored with the Anthony, McCavity, Barry, and Dillis Awards, and he's also won the Minnesota Book Award 5 times, right? You should retire it, yeah.
I don't submit anymore, I feel bad.
Julia Keller is the author of the Belpha Elkins novel set in West Virginia. She won the Barry Award for her wonderful first novel, Killing in the Hills, and was nominated for a Mary Higgins Clark Award. She's a professor and a journalist, as well as a writer. And her career has included a Pulitzer Prize for feature writing. Welcome.
Whoa!
And that's really true. You can check on that, too.
It's true.
You can Google it.
Yeah, I'm not making it up. And I've read every word both of you have written, and I'm a huge fan. I think mysteries are such a wonderful genre because, along with telling a great story, they also highlight current social issues, and your new novels each tackle really heavy stuff, border immigration issues, drug abuse. Could each of you talk about what made you want to write about these topics this time?
I can start. I think somebody may have seen the 60 Minutes report on Sunday night on the DEA and some of the issues, the great opioid crisis that's facing this country. I come from a town born and raised in Huntington, West Virginia. My father was a professor at Marshall University there, was a mathematics professor. So one day I was sitting in the Chicago Tribune newsroom where I was working, and I picked up a copy of the LA Times, which the Tribune owned at that time. And there was a story called The Heroin Road. It was about black tar heroin. This was in 2012. And the dateline said Huntington, West Virginia. You could have knocked me over. I mean, the town I grew up in was, you know, you go and catch, you know, crawdads in the creek and ride your bike and stay out till all hours, and because the neighbors were always watching you just as well as your parents could, and a great place to grow up. And it has turned into what several newspapers and CNN and a lot of places have called the heroin capital of the country. Unbelievable how this has happened. Combination of a lot of factors, which we can talk about, but it's been very well covered by journalism, by the fact-based media. To my mind, though, fiction has a special role to play in issues of great social challenge like we're facing now in this opioid crisis. So my books are about a woman who comes back to her hometown in West Virginia, Acres Gap, which is a fictional town based on Guyandal, which is a small town next to Huntington, even smaller than Huntington. And she comes back because she wants to make a difference. It's her hometown, and she sees the way the opioid crisis is just wreaking havoc on these small towns in Appalachia. So that was what got me writing in general. This specific book, Fast Falls the Night, which is the sixth book in the series, takes place in a single 24-hour period during which there's a record number of heroin overdoses. I happened to be back in Huntington on August 15th, 2016, last year, and just by coincidence, I was there actually at a library event to hear an author, hear a local author read. Got home, and the next day read on CNN.com that in a four-hour period, Huntington had 33 drug overdoses with two fatalities. It's the single greatest number of overdoses in anywhere in a four-hour period in a single area. Completely overwhelmed the public safety network. So I was already at work on this novel. I completely reworked it in light of that and made it within this 24-hour period. Again, I think fiction has a special role to play at such times. We have tremendous journalism in this country. We have extraordinary journalism, and the opioid crisis has been covered beautifully, tragically beautifully, by the London Guardian as well as the New York Times. The New Yorker did a big piece. The LA Times, the Chicago Tribune, my newspaper. But fiction has something else to say. It's another way of coming at the truth. As Emily Dickinson said, tell the truth, but tell it slant. And that's something that has a special role for fiction. And that's just kind of me groping for a way to tell the story about my hometown and what's become of it.
Wow.
Can't follow that.
So if you're familiar with my Cork O'Connor series, you may be aware that very often at the heart of my stories is a significant contemporary social issue about which I feel quite strongly. So I've written about the tragic situation that exists in many communities that have a significant native population that involves the sexual trafficking of vulnerable native women and children. I've written about the rape of the land and the resources, particularly native land and resources, by deep pocket, uncaring corporations. We used to have in literature what we called the social novel. And these were books that had at the heart of them an important contemporary social issue that the author wanted to bring to the awareness of a larger public. So think about Charles Dickens. All of his novels were social novels. Think about Upton Sinclair or Theodore Dreiser. These were all social novelists. We don't really have social novels anymore, per se. What's taken their place, in my opinion, are novels in our genre, the crime genre. And very often you're going to read a fine crime novel that, in addition to being a wonderfully suspenseful read, talks about an important contemporary social issue. So writing about the issue at the heart of Sulphur Springs was nothing new to me. It's about the wall that, as nearly as I can tell, is supposed to go taller and longer. It's about this arbitrary line marked across our continent that tragically divides two nations, two people, and very, very tragically divides families now as a result of our policies. Okay, here's a confession. I am an unrepentant, bleeding heart liberal.
Shocker.
And I have a profound opinion on how we need to respond to this crisis. And one of the things that I love about what we do is that you can put at the heart of a good, compelling mystery, an important social issue. And as long as the mystery surrounding it is compelling, even people who don't necessarily agree with you will still read you. And I love the fact that I can get up on a soapbox and spout off without giving the other side an opportunity for rebuttal. How often do you get that chance?
You've heard the joke recently that the only wall we need in this country is the one around Harvey Weinstein.
Yet that is so true.
Well, more on a more practical writing level, how do you balance out putting these social issues in and telling a great story at the same time?
Yeah, I think you were talking a little bit about that, yeah. Kent, the idea that the entertainment has to be at the center of it. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I mean, you've got to... You know, what's the old friend of mine is in sales and always says, you know, they don't care how much you know till they know how much you care. I think it's the same thing with a novel. It has to be entertaining. You have to have a good story there with compelling characters because nobody wants to hear us talk politics. Nobody wants to hear anybody talk politics, I don't think. I mean, you know, you try to listen to some of this and it's just, there's such just such vehemence on both sides and no one's really listening. But in a novel, uniquely, I think, you can dramatize some of these great social issues. I mean, my contention is, and again, I don't mean to sound so highfalutin, which I probably did in my initial talk there, but to me, the great moral crucible of our time, there are many of them, but is the opioid crisis, and here's why. Because it asked us to examine our own values and principles, because people, in many cases, have brought this on themselves. So how many times do we give people? A friend of mine is an ER doc, and she says, when I see the same people 10, 11, 12 times in a row, coming in with overdoses. She says they want, you know, Narcan. That's, some of you know, that's what's, it's an amazing drug that completely, it instantly reverses the effects of an opioid overdose. Great, wonderful to have that medication. But when somebody comes in, and they've come in, you know, half a dozen times, so it asks us, what should we do about that? What do we owe people who have brought their own troubles on themselves? And that, to me, is a great moral question. And you can do it in a mystery, as Kent says. It's a wonderful platform to look at some of these issues that we're all wrestling with, whether we know it or not, because it's our dollars at stake, it's our public facilities at stake, and you can do that uniquely in fiction. But it's a hard balance to strike. I mean, it's a great question because you can always tell, you know, a novel that's too much hectoring platitude and not enough just good story. What Ian Forrester called the caveman question, what happens next? And there's nothing at all wrong with it. I mean, that's the most basic question, isn't it, at the heart of anything we read? What happens next? You want to turn that page, and if you don't, you know, I haven't done my job.
What is it that makes any story worth reading? It's a story about people. And if you take a social issue and you give it a human face, people tend to look at it in a different way. If you do it well, you touch hearts, not minds. A really good story goes for the heart. Why do you care about Oliver Twist? You care about Oliver. You know, you fall in love with that kid who's struggling. More, please.
You're on a Dickens kick, aren't you? Somebody's been reading a lot of 19th century literature, I'd say.
Why do you care about the Grapes of Wrath? Because you love the Joad family. You are drawn in, you care about the Joad family, the face of the Depression. So what I try to do when I write a story about an issue is give it that human face. The issue is important, but what's really important is how this issue has an impact on human beings. And if you create a story in which people fall in love with your characters, they are going to appreciate the story and maybe be affected by it. You know, I knew when I wrote Sulphur Springs, I'm writing about one of the most divisive issues in our nation right now, the border issue, undocumented immigrants. I tend to think of them as refugees. And I knew that there were going to be really powerful feelings on both sides of the issue. And in fact, this is the first book I've ever written in which I've had readers write to me and say, "You bleeding heart bastard,
really?
I am never going to read you again." But I expected that response. I expected that response. But what I also hoped was that there would be people out there who believed a certain way that maybe I didn't believe. But when they understood the human face, when they understood the impact on human beings that our policies have, maybe they would give it a second thought.
I hope so. Was it refreshing to get Cork out of town?
Oh, it was so much fun. So for those of you who don't, Sulphur Springs takes place in southern Arizona. Most of my series, for those of you who aren't aware of it, takes place in the Great North Woods of Minnesota. I've written 16 books in that series. This is the third book in which I've taken Cork out of Minnesota because I wanted to talk about the border issue. And I could have talked about the Canadian border issue, but it's not nearly as, as interesting. So I didn't know southern Arizona very well before I wrote. You know, I just had these sort of really, the images I had of southern Arizona, honestly, were primarily formed from all of the Roadrunner Coyote cartoons I watched when I was a kid. So I had to go down there and do an enormous amount of research. And as a result of that, God, I loved the research. I loved figuring out the culture in southern Arizona. It's this incredible mix of cultural influences. There's the Spanish and the Mexican and the Native American and that crazy cowboy culture down there. It's this cauldron in which this witch's brew of cultural influences are kind of bubbling away. And oh my God, was it fun to sink myself into that cultural mix, to try to understand it better so I could offer it to readers in an understandable way, and to get to know the spirit of southern Arizona was a remarkable journey, too. I loved that part of the research that I did.
Well, it just made the book really stand out, I think. Both of you write about family. It seems very important to both of your characters. You have a little more optimistic view. Bella's a hard time with her family. And you talk about how the family issues define your characters.
Oh gosh, you're right. They are everything, and you worry about that too. You know, when you're a writer, you write these books, and then you don't really think about, wait a minute, my mother's going to read this. And I used to think that was only true when you worried about like sex scenes and things like that, right? Because your parent, you don't ever want your parents to know you even know about such things. But really, the family part has been even more. You know, I come from a family that has its share of troubles and its share of some of the issues I deal with when I'm books. People in the family do as well. I mean, it's well disguised. I don't think I would never write directly about anybody because it's not a memoir. And I'm certainly not Belle Elkin. She's much stronger than me, much smarter, and really a very different kind of a person. I think a harder person too, you know, than I am. She's, I always say she's a difficult person to be friends with, but she is the kind of person you'd want as a friend, though, you know, there beside you the whole way. But I do think that family is at the heart of everything, mm-hmm. For good and for ill. And there is a great tradition of that, of course, in West Virginia. I mean, you're kinfolk. It's a real thing, and you are part of you come from people. I've heard Henry Louis Gates talk about that. You know, and you're told when you're young, you come from people, meaning you came from somewhere. You're a part of something else, and that's your bones. Your bones were knit out of that. And again, it's for good and bad. You know, I've got some relatives that I wouldn't want to introduce here tonight, and I've got some other others that I'm very, very proud of. So it's, you know, it's this great, tremendous mixed bag, and perhaps that's the journey of our lives, is figuring out where we fit in at the end of that trail, because we are. I mean, we are where all roads lead in our families. It's us, where we stand, and trying to figure out what that means, what parts we are. Some of the compulsions and the, you know, I talk about a thing called Appalachian fatalism, which I think is quite real. When you are from the area of the country that I'm from, there is this fatalism. My father certainly had it. Brilliant man, brilliant mathematician. And yet he was always shadowed. He died quite young. He was 51. He died. He always had this sense of things aren't really going to improve. They're not really going to, you know, there's an old joke about the optimist and the pessimist arguing. And the pessimist says, things can't get any worse. And the optimist says, sure they can.
That's the Appalachian optimist.
But I'm bummed.
Exactly. And that's West Virginia in a nutshell. I mean, you live in the shadow of those mountains, and you, another friend of mine used to always say, the only way out is up. You are in this place, and it leads to this fatalism. And I've seen how that shadow has kind of spread over my family and the families of the people that I know and grew up with. And that's what I try to sort of imbue my books with as well, is that sense, that family sense, that deep, dark, sometimes glorious and golden, but always, always tenacious and eternal sense of family.
You've put Cork through a lot.
Yeah, I put Cork. Yeah. Yeah, but that's what makes an interesting read.
Yeah.
You know, if you put the people the reader cares about in jeopardy, it's going to be a good suspenseful story. when people ask me what I write about who aren't really familiar with my work, I say I write about three things. I write about Minnesota, I write about the Ojibwe culture, and I write about family. When I first sat down to write a mystery many, many years ago, for anybody who's taken a writing class, what's the first tenet they try to pound into your head? Write what you know, right? Write what you know. When you sit down to, when that first time, at least I, when I sat down to write Iron Lake, I realized that, you know, there were so many things I was going to be writing about that I didn't know. Forensic investigation, ballistics, the minds of serial killers, you know. And so I thought, okay, if I really believe the tenet, write what you know, and I do, then the question was, how was I going to write what I know and still write a mystery? So I decided I'm going to put three things at the heart of my mysteries. I know Minnesota. So Minnesota is going to be this, it's an adopted home for me, and I love it. And so I was going to put Minnesota at the heart of my stories. I began this when I was in my early 40s, and I thought after 40 years of living, I understand human nature pretty well. So human nature is one of the foundations of the stories. And the other thing was is that I was a family man. I understood what it was to be a family man and the hard work of being a family man. And so I was going to write about family. And that's pretty much what I've stuck with.
Why did you include the Ojibwe culture? Why was that a...
Yeah, the first decision I made in my Cork O'Connor series was to set it up in the Great North Woods of Minnesota. I'm not native to Minnesota. My wife Diane and I moved there when she was about 30 so she could go to the University of Minnesota Law School. And before that, I was a gypsy kid. I lived all over the place. I never really had anywhere that I called or thought of as home. But honest to God, the minute I set foot in Minnesota, I knew I'd found home. I fell in love with that place. So I always knew when I got serious, I would be writing about Minnesota. When I discovered that beautiful north country of Minnesota, particularly the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness in the Arrowhead, I knew that's what I was going to write about. And then when I took a really good look at northern Minnesota, I realized you can't tell a true story set in northern Minnesota without including the Ojibwe as an element of the work, because their influence up there is ubiquitous. It's everywhere, and it's powerful. So that's when I made the decision to include the Ojibwe. And then I started reading Tony Hillerman and thought, yeah, I made a good decision.
You did make a good decision, I agree. Was this new book at all, were you influenced by Red Harvest? It kind of reminded me of Hammett.
I'm sorry?
It reminded me of Hammett's Red Harvest as I was reading it, Sulphur Springs.
Do you like Red Harvest?
I love Red Harvest.
Okay.
I think it's like a
it's my least
novel.
Favorite book of his.
I think it's like where you can see the Western becoming a mystery.
I know, I know.
I mean, that's why I like it. I like
I think I'm closer to Elmore Leonard's Westerns with Sulphur Springs.
Really?
If like you know Elmore Leonard's Westerns.
Well, I do. But so, and my question for you is, you structured your book within a 24-hour time period. Was that harder or easier?
Much harder.
That's
much
what
harder.
I was wondering.
Yeah.
That seemed like it would be really
hard. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I probably thought it would be easier, but no, because for one thing, your things can happen simultaneously, but you can't have like, what do you have, it divided into two columns on the page? I mean, things had to happen, but, and who's aware of what, at what time, and what's going on, and I had a lot of characters to juggle. Mm-hmm. No, it was enormously difficult.
I haven't read it yet, tricky. Julia, I'm sorry. Is it limited third person, multiple third person?
Various viewpoints of my characters,
yeah.
Belle Elkins is a primary one, but there's also a deputy sheriff. There's a sort of a pastor who has fallen.
What great characters, pastors who have fallen.
Pastors who
They're
have fallen,
so rich.
I know. Anybody, I love, sort of sanctimony stripped bare by the realities of life.
There's
right?
a pastor in the background. Oh, really? Yeah.
Are you fallen?
Yeah, she's not fallen. I don't think so.
But no, it's much harder. I'm writing the next one now, and I find it's like, oh, now, right, I can write a regular novel now where time passes and, you know, people do various things and their lives go on. But no, I found it very difficult, a great technical challenge that I didn't anticipate.
Yeah, I think it's almost like writing a locked room mystery, and now you've done it. You don't have to do it again.
Well, but
Well, I think both of you have such a specific voice from your first book. I mean, no other person could have written your books, and I think partly it's because of your setting, which you each have the setting shape your narrative, which I don't think everybody's able to do at all. And can you each talk about how you use the setting to shape your narrative and why?
Well, you know, I'm interested that you did it on purpose because I will say I didn't ever expect to write about West Virginia. I mean, I left when I went to graduate school. I went to Marshall undergraduate, then graduate school at Ohio State, and then I've lived in Chicago for 12 years working for the Chicago Tribune, and that's where I began these novels. I never expected to write about West Virginia. That was not anything I felt. I was sort of glad to have it in the rearview mirror, frankly. I mean, not because it was a bad place, but because it's so stigmatizing. I can tell you in Chicago, when I first moved there to work for the Tribune, I had colleagues come up and say, "You're from West Virginia? Did I hear the rumor right?" And I said, "Yeah." And one of my colleagues said, "Are you sure?" And I said, "Yeah." And then he said, one of those backhanded compliments, to this day he denies he said it, but he said it, "All I got to say is you're doing wonders for the reputation of that state." That's not really a compliment. I would never name names, but he's Tim Bannon, the current sports editor. No, but truly, I didn't want it. I felt like it was almost like I was sort of pulled kicking and screaming into writing about it. That's why I love the fact that I would say I don't love West Virginia. I say I love it and I hate it. In that way, you know, we're kind of like, it's this great sort of tumult in my soul about being from West Virginia, because again, it has such a, well, think of the image. I mean, when you say West Virginia, it's the last prejudice available. People, when I was a kid, we would travel, because my dad got his graduate degrees. One of them was at University of Arizona at Tucson, so we lived in Tucson for 3 summers, and then Urbana-Champaign, University of Illinois, for his PhD, and people literally, you say from West Virginia, I was just a kid, and they look at your feet.
to see
if you have
shoes
on.
Really?
True story. I mean, imagine such a, I mean, a prejudice. I look back on it now, and it's horrifying that people would have that. So I really didn't, I was compelled to do it. And I wonder, too, if I can just ask, do you feel that you're somewhat marginalized by writing about a place? I mean, I have felt that from time to time. I felt that certain reviewers will, you know, as writers, we're always, right, we're sensitive to every slight. But it's this idea about, well, it's just West Virginia. How important could this be? These are, like, these people are not real people. They're not a viewer for a large major publication in a big city once said that. I mean, sort of implied that in the review. Like, yeah, but these are almost like they were people in a petting zoo or something. They were exotic, strange, weird. They don't have the same ideas as other people. After all, they live there. Who would live there if they had other choice? That sort of thing. I mean, truly. I know I sound all embittered, don't I? Really? But
if you read the books, the characters are, you know, they're universal. They're not.
The same lust, greed, yeah. hate, jealousy, rage that we all experience every day, and yet there is a society. It's a very exotic place to be from, and I had to kind of live my way into, and now it's just fine with me. I mean, I love the idea of being from West Virginia, and that is where my family's from, but I came to it with some struggle, I have to say. But you seem to, you love Minnesota, but it's so cold, Kent.
Keeps the riffraff out. You know, I had the great good fortune of hearing Tony Hillerman's one-time editor, a guy named Eamon Dolenz, talk about Hillerman and this work. And in the course of his talk, he threw out a term that has always stayed with me. He said what Tony Hillerman writes is domestica exotica. And what he meant by that was, and he said American readers love domestica exotica. And what he meant by that was they love stories that are set within the confines of the continental United States, domestic, but they love being taken to a place they don't know at all, so it's exotic to them. Mm-hmm. And anybody who reads the Tony Hillerman series, you know that Four Corners area that he writes about, well, people in New York City sure think it's exotic, in the same way that they think Minnesota is exotic. And what he said was is that readers love an author who takes them to that place and delivers it to them in a way that when they leave the book, they feel they've been there. They've really experienced that place. And that's what I want. That's what I hope readers leave one of my Cork O'Connors or Ordinary Grace feeling like they've been in this place. When I teach writing, I always teach setting as the first of the narrative elements.
Before character? Setting
before character. Before atmosphere, before voice. It even comes before plot in my thinking.
Really?
Because I think in my work and the work of those writers I admire, everything rises out of place. You read a James Lee Burke novel. Mm-hmm. The characters that inhabit that place are unique because of the culture of the place. The plot, the motives rise out of the reason that place is the way it is. And so in Minnesota, the characters, the plot, the atmosphere, mm-hmm. The issues, the motivations, all of these things, more often than not, rise out of the fact that northern Minnesota is the kind of place that it is.
I agree.
Mm. I don't know, I'm just thinking though, but the vast majority of crime fiction is New York and L.A.
Well, and that's why I mean, that reaction, who cares about West Virginia?
I don't think that's as true anymore.
I agree.
Tony Hillerman was the guy that started it. It's a way, and James Lee
Burke.
But you look at
exist,
C.J. Box, you look at Craig Johnson, you look at Margaret Cole,
but
look at Dennis
Michael
Lehane.
Conley. Look, I mean, I could give you as many on the other side. I don't know. I think that the big city is still the...
It's still big.
Wait a minute.
These mean streets.
Louise Penny and Three Pines.
There you go. It's as big as this room, probably. Yeah.
But I understand exactly what you're saying. But I do believe it is changed. It has changed and it continues to change. But New York and maybe L.A. continue to feel like the whole rest of the nation is just the great flyover.
Well, in Chicago, though. No, I should add, great, great mystery writers in Chicago, too.
So true.
There's Michael Harvey.
So
and there's a great new tradition of that. Yeah, so big cities. But, no, that's the first question I got. The very first event I did after my book, it was in Chicago, and somebody said, why didn't you set it in Chicago? You know, you're a Chicagoan. And I thought, why didn't I? I don't know. I can't.
Well,
Did you say because people in Chicago wear shoes?
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite of your books is Summer of the Dead. I think that's the one where the miner has been in the mines for so long he can't stand up straight anymore. Now, what else could you write about that guy?
Yeah, I had to put a little author's note at the beginning because I knew nobody would believe me, but it was a real story that I did. You remember when... the movie October Sky came out based on Rocket Boys, wonderful mm-hmm. memoir of Homer Hickam, who grew up in war West Virginia, extreme
Jake
southern
Gyllenhaal,
West Virginia.
Early role.
Yeah. Oh, it's a wonderful movie. If you haven't seen that movie, it's an American classic, as is Rocket Boys, which is the original book that October Sky was based on. But I had been down there, and I met a woman in, well, it's McDowell, we would say McDowell, but down there it's pronounced McDowell County, West Virginia. And she, in fact, the last Walmart just closed in McDowell County, to tell you how impoverished it is. Oh, when the Walmart closes, you're in big trouble. But in any case, I was down there, and I was interviewing a woman for a story on when Rocket Boys came out. This is when I first went to Chicago, one of the first feature stories I did. I said, let me go back to West Virginia and do this story. I was interviewing this woman, and she told me her husband, she'd made a home for him under their kitchen table because he couldn't straighten up. So she put pillows and blankets. It's the only place he was comfortable. So I moved that to a basement, but mm-hmm. used it in my book, and I knew nobody would believe it. I mean, it sounded too, talk about exotic.
That is so heartbreaking.
I mean, somebody making a home underneath it because he couldn't straighten up after all the years in the mine. So I pointed out to people that it really was true. I mean, I'd been there. I'd seen his place there under the kitchen table. She would tell me that in McDowell County, now, as I said, now it can't even support a Walmart, she would say to me, she said, people, the natural speech of people, I know you know this as well, Kent, is so beautiful. I mean, the rhythms of it is the best poetry ever. She said to me, oh, Saturday night here, when I was a little girl, people were back to back and belly to belly.
Well, who here is a Cork O'Connor fan? Just raise your hand.
I love you guys.
Pretty much everyone. So one of your central characters is Henry Malou. Well, he's getting very old, Kent. Now, is he going to live forever?
I will say this. I have just finished number 17 in the Cork O'Connor series. It's called Desolation Mountain. It'll be out this time next year. And to answer your question, you need to read that book.
Aww. And I wonder.
That's all I'm saying.
Okay, well, can I ask about Stevie? Because it seems like he might be stepping up a little bit.
Desolation Mountain is in large measure Stevie's story.
Oh, okay.
Stephen. He is Stephen now.
Oh, Stephen. I'm sorry. I can't only think of him as Stevie. Yeah.
So for those of you who don't know my series, it spans 15 years, 16 years now in the lives of Cork O'Connor and his family. So his youngest child, Stevie, when the series began, he was 5 years old and he was mm-hmm. Stevie. But when he became a teenager, he wanted to be called Stephen. And so he's been Stephen ever since. And Stephen is a kid who, more than anybody in Cork's family, shows his genetic his Ojibwe genetic heritage. He's dark-haired, he has fine cheekbones, facial features, almond eyes, and he wants to be a Mi'kmaq. He has all his life dreamed of being a member of the Grand Medicine Society, a Mi'kmaq, a healer. And so many of the stories have dealt with him wanting to be on that path. Desolation Mountain deals significantly with his trying to, he also has visions. And they're always terrible visions. And Desolation Mountain, he sees a terrible vision and he wants to run away from it. And so it's part of his accepting who he is mm-hmm. and the role he has been assigned by the great spirit, the great mystery in his life. It's a good story, folks.
It sounds wonderful, yeah. And can I also ask, when you wrote Ordinary Grace, which I think of as an American classic, I mean, so how do you move past writing a book that's that great, and are you tired of talking about it?
I know I never get tired of hearing American classic associated with my book.
It reminds me of To Kill a Mockingbird. It's such a great book.
Well, thank you. You know, when I talk to writers, whenever I address writers and I'm talking about Ordinary Grace, I say to them, I hope you have this experience in your journey as a writer. I hope at some point you discover that story that feels to you as if you were born to write it. This was the story you were always meant to write. And that was Ordinary Grace for me. But I'm a storyteller, so my stories don't stop there. I may never write a story as fine as Ordinary Grace is, but that doesn't mean I'm not going to write stories.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. Well, you guys are like answering questions. Before
hey, wait a minute.
I ask them.
Can we throw you a question?
All right.
Is that kosher?
No.
Okay.
Yes, of course.
I didn't discuss this with you before, Julia, but 25 years. Do you know how unusual that is for an independent bookstore these days to have been in business for 25 years, a quarter of a century. So I want to know two things. I want to know why you made the decision to get into this crazy business in the first place.
We didn't know any better.
Okay. That's too simple.
Yeah. But.
So answer that one first, and then I'll throw the next one at you.
Well, the true answer is I love mysteries, and I always have. And Jamie, my partner, had been working at Borders, and we thought if we opened a store, it should have a niche. And mysteries are such a huge genre. We have 30,000 books that you can specialize in them. And plus, they're great.
Have you always been at the Aunt Agatha's location?
Yes.
Right from the get-go?
Right. It used to be the seedy side of town.
Oh, so rent was cheap.
Yeah. No. Well, our landlord had redone it, so we got in at a good moment.
And how the odds against an independent bookstore succeeding these days are enormous, primarily because of Amazon, that huge, faceless, uncaring entity for whom books are nothing more than units to be moved, like shoes and taco makers. And they undercut every independent bookseller.
Absolutely.
And they don't pay taxes. And there are all kinds of things wrong with that monster. How, against these kinds of odds, have you managed to survive?
Well, it's sometimes dicey. And as a lot of you are customers, you know, we sell used books, and those really help carry us because they're cheap and people buy a lot of them and we don't pay a lot to get them.
And you've established a clientele that trusts you, comes in time and time again.
A lot of them are sitting here.
Who has ever had a bad book recommendation from Robin or Jamie? There you go.
There are people.
Oh, wait a minute. I saw a guy.
Actually, there was a woman I sold a book to that came in for the next 5 years and told me how much she hated that book. I think she's over it now. But.
I think it's actually kind of scary to recommend books to people.
Oh,
I've gotten
so
a little gun-shy about it. Well,
it's really
but
fun.
You can go wrong in spectacular ways. And if
you
people
can.
Come and say, what were you thinking? And slap the book down.
Do you know, if you love a book and you recommend it and they come back and it's like, I didn't get it. It's just like a personal affront.
Oh, it's true.
It is.
Actually, if people come in, they don't like your books, I'm like, I can't even wait on you, really. You have to get out of here.
Right, we can't be friends anymore. It's true.
It's true. There's a couple authors I feel that way about.
Well, and you and I disagree about a major author. Vehemently disagree.
Yes,
and yet we've remained friends,
and yet
I think.
We can be friends.
Yeah. Oh, why did you bring that up? Wait, I did.
You brought it up, so why don't you tell?
No. This is what I love, though. It's the diversity. I love it. I love it to run into somebody that loves something that left me completely cold. There is no better experience. And I'll say, just explain to me. Tell me what it does for you. I mean, that's what I love to hear. I was a cultural critic for the Tribune, and what I love more than my opinion was other people's opinions. Something that is vastly popular that did nothing for me. I am fascinated by trying to figure out what it was that somebody else got out of it. I mean, I'm just utterly fascinated
and
by that.
And this is one of the values I see in a book, being a part of a book club. Because I will often have a response
to
a book, and when I go to my book club and we discuss it, I come away with a different impression.
Yeah.
Oh, I
sometimes
didn't see
like
all
it
of these
better.
Things.
Yeah, and that's what, you know, that's what great criticism should do, and that's one of the things, the demise of newspapers is also the demise of critics, daily critics in newspapers for films, for television. Mm-hmm. You know, I was a television critic at the Columbus Dispatch for many years, Columbus, Ohio. And people say to me, well, why do we need a TV critic there? We can just get one from LA or get the opinion out of New York or whatever. See, there's something about this great diversity of opinion. If you're a critic, you're arguing the coherence of your opinions. That's what Robert Hughes, the great Time Magazine art critic, would say. And there's nothing better than when somebody disagrees completely and argues with you, you know, responsibly, and there's nothing better. It's exhilarating when somebody says, you're wrong and here's why. You know, and that's
wrong.
What, I used to love that. I would tell you, I had a great record as a television critic. There was a show that came out, a sitcom, and I said, this thing, nobody's ever going to, this will be gone anyway. It was a little something called Friends. True story. But I will also tell you that my great triumph was a little show called ER premiered the same year as something called Chicago Hope, medical show. Do you remember?
I do.
Every critic in this country, you can look it up, said Chicago Hope is going to be the big hit. ER, no way. And I said, ER is the one. So I have, you know, good
so
and bad.
You were right, yeah.
Yeah, now if I could just transfer that to lottery winners, you know, lottery number picks.
Well,
but no, it's that diversity.
Every
that,
bookseller I know, like the Da Vinci Code, we got the advanced copy. We're like, what?
Yeah.
We didn't get it. And
but there's something but about that. What is that? I mean, what is that? I mean, people can take that down, all that, not that you were doing that, but you read a lot of savage, famous, critical put-downs of the Da Vinci Code or any big bestseller like that, right? People tearing it apart, and they love to make fun and mock and who could ever. And it's like, there's something in this that people are responding to because books are something that you don't stick with if you don't like, right? Once you get beyond high school when you're forced to read, I don't know, Dickens. Where'd that come from?
Or Hawthorne.
But
popular opinion, what makes a book popular is so hard to pin down
exactly.
and predict.
Impossible.
Okay, so the Da Vinci Code is a really good example. Mm-hmm. So for those... If you haven't read The Da Vinci Code, it's probably the most plot-driven novel you will ever read with many of the most obvious two-dimensional characters you will ever stumble
short
across.
Short chapters, all the...
But
yeah.
It also happens to be the best-selling piece of American fiction of all time. Da Vinci Code is currently...
Is that true?
It is true. The
wow.
best-selling
yeah.
piece. Now, that's I have so a question sad. For you. Does anyone here know what The Da Vinci Code replaced? As the best-selling piece of American fiction of all time? What was the best-selling piece of American fiction before The Da Vinci Code came along? Oh, I so love you. To Kill a Mockingbird, I would so love that to be the correct answer. Anybody else have a guess?
No idea.
Uncle Tom's Cabin, a great classic, but that's not the one. What? Peyton places closer to the mark. Here it is.
Valley of the Dolls?
The Valley of the Dolls by Jacqueline Suzanne. I kid
really?
You not. I kid you not.
I didn't
but you
know that. Yeah.
And because it's hard to predict, yeah. These are just phenomenons of a particular point
right.
in time. Who reads the Valley of the Dolls anymore, right? 15 years from now, nobody's going to be reading The Da Vinci Code,
nobody
but 15 years from now, 50 years from now, 150 years from now, people are still going to be reading To Kill a Mockingbird and Uncle Tom's Cabin
and
Huck
Grace.
Finn and Ordinary Grace. Thank you.
But I still say the larger issue than just the popularity is the idea of people have passions for individual books.
Yeah.
And if I don't share that passion, I love hearing them tell me why they love it and what's... I was just talking to a friend of mine here. We were talking about, she was saying that her book group will read books that she doesn't particularly care for. But you go to the book group, and mm-hmm. then like you're saying, you find out, like, well, what is it that, and
so
they'll point out something.
So it's an appropriate response, because I look at paintings and I go, I can't tell you why I like it, but I like it. So is an appropriate response to that is, I don't know, I just liked it.
But there's something about it. You like a character or something that happens in the story, or there's something.
Or conversely,
about it. You know.
Why didn't you like it?
Yeah,
when
right,
people
yeah.
say, oh, I didn't like that book of yours. Yeah. I'm talking about your work, not mine.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know, yeah. I want them to be able to tell me specifically why you didn't like it. As
I can tell you,
to,
though,
just,
as a critic, though, I always found it was real easy to tear something apart. Trashing something was great fun. You know, out comes the pen, and you just rip it apart, and it's great, and there's never any consequence and all that. In fact, there was a bad review once of a Laurence Olivier performance by somebody in, I don't know, you know, Peoria, Illinois or something. And it led to the great headline, Crushed by Nobodies. So tearing something apart is great sport. But I decided as a critic, it's really true, and I discovered that talking about why you love something, why it speaks to you, why it lodges in your soul and won't leave again, that's very difficult when you think
that's
of it. Other than
harder.
Just we have so many, all of our platitudes, everything, oh, I liked it was good, the characters were good, no. Tell me for real, get very specific. It's hard. It's very hard. Think about it. If you were trying to convince us to read something that meant so much to you, it's very, very hard to come up with something other than cliches and platitudes, you know, and you struggle and you think, I can't put it into words, and it's very hard, much harder to write praise. Criticism.
Yeah, our book club is very quiet on a book that we loved, a book we hated that we can tear apart. Boy, that's a lively discussion.
That's it, everybody, yeah. We love it, yeah.
Can I just ask everyone in my book club to stand up, because I really appreciate you guys, and there's a lot of you here. I see there's, stand
Robin's
up,
book
they
club.
Mean it. I just want to give you a little
there
hand.
They are.
Thank you, Linda.
Do you have a name?
You know,
how long have you been?
Club?
How long have you been together?
24 years.
Oh my goodness!
Original member right there.
You know, one of the great
daughter grow up and have babies, and
one of the great features in the Tribune in our book section, we began a thing called book clubs. We profile a book club once a week, And one of the editors said, oh, there won't even, people won't, number one, they won't want to talk about it. Number two, there won't be enough to, well, it's still going strong. Like 5 years later, it's the most popular feature. Yeah. People send in pictures. They talk about, some people are, they're history book club, some, you know, mostly men, mostly women, co-ed. The Tribune once had a raffle, you know, for United Way, and what you won as your prize was have me come to your book club. You know, you're thinking like,
that's
really,
a good prize.
But the idea was, you know, you'd have a professional critic there at your book club, and we read The Sense of an Ending, you know, the Julian Barnes book, and then we disagreed.
I hated that book.
I didn't like it either. That was a great conversation. Half the people loved it, half the people hated it, yeah. But made a wonderful, lively conversation.
I bet.
The book club, I mean, what a great phenomenon. It's just...
Oh, it's wonderful. It's such a great way to get together once a month. And
do you really read the books? Like, if you don't like, when do you quit? Like, how far into the book if you don't like it? Or do you always read every word of
if
every book?
If it's a book club book, I read it all. But for any other book, 50 pages. Unless I'm reviewing it for a magazine. But then I... Yes, ma'am?
The mic, so I'm going to come right up here, and then you can ask your question. So hang on. Takes me a little while.
Thank you. This has been one of the more interesting discussions I have been to. This has been wonderful. I'd like to ask both of you, because when I read a book, particularly about a place with which I'm familiar, I find myself noticing errors in the location. And I wonder if you've both had experience of hearing from writers about you put that on the wrong side of the street or, you know, something else is going on.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I misspelled Greenbrier in A Killing in the Hills. The Greenbrier, some of you know, the resort
hotel?
in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia. In fact, that's what I thought your book was about, Sulphur Springs. He left out the white part.
It's a fancy book.
Acres Gap is fictional, but I give sort of a general idea of where it is. And I got a detailed letter from a woman exactly who pointed out my geography was could not be true. It can't be that close to Washington, D.C., and yet still be half an hour from Charleston and still, yeah. And I love that. I mean, how wonderful to have readers attentive enough. Mm-hmm. I love it. Belle's love interest in the first book has sort of reddish blonde hair, and then in book four, suddenly it's brown. And I had missed a complete. And it's incredible privilege, you know, to get that kind of a note from somebody because they're not so much got you as in, like,
just
you
want
need
to help
pay attention to this. So it's really quite wonderful. But geographically, yes. I mean, I've been wrong. And it's. I said I really love it when people point that out. I mean, now you know, I didn't love it as a newspaper reporter. I should say I'm always saying to people that you know if you get something wrong in a newspaper, you're really sick to your stomach for a week. I mean, it's dreadful. I don't know if people understand that. But if you find a mistake in a paper and they run a correction, as the writer, you are completely humiliated. There's no worse feeling in the world. But as a fiction writer, it's like, eh.
Right. You made it up, right?
Yeah. How about you, Ken?
It's fiction. Yeah. When my second novel, Boundary Waters, came out, the opening scene has a guy taking, the opening scene takes place in the Boundary Waters canoe area wilderness, and a guy takes a stick out of the fire. And that stick has to hold the ember on the end of that, on the end of it, that hot, red hot ember, for reasons I won't go into. So I needed a really good, hard wood, and so I made it ironwood. And I had a friend of mine who was an aficionado of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness read my book, and he said, oh, Kent, there are no ironwood trees in the Boundary Waters. So I said, okay, I still need a good, hard wood. So I went to my handy-dandy Little Trees of Minnesota book and went through them in beech. Oh, beech is a good hard wood. It's here in Minnesota. That's what my little icon at the bottom of the page says. So I made it a beech stick. Well, the book comes out, and 2 weeks after it's out, I get a nice note from a woman saying, "Dear Mr. Kruger, I have just finished Boundary Waters. I have to tell you, I love the story, but there are no beech trees in northern Minnesota." And I said, "Well, now, wait a minute." So I went back to my handy-dandy Little Trees of Minnesota handbook, opened to the beech tree page, looked at the little icon down in the corner, little icon of Minnesota, the state of Minnesota, and there's a line drawn right through the with this little microscopic text that says, "No beech trees north of this line." So yeah, it happens.
Else? Okay.
Oh, and she's way over here.
I know.
You gotta walk really far.
They're keeping me busy today. Hang on just a moment.
He's running.
It's like this night show, yeah. You know, when they go.
It's
and
the
they...
Tim show, yeah.
I'm so glad to see you guys again. I have a question for both Julia and Kent. I was wondering, Julia, since Kent has taken his character out of Minnesota, northern Minnesota, for a few books, if you've got any plans to take Belle out and find an adventure somewhere?
Well, those of you who've read Fast Falls a Night know that there is a rather momentous event that occurs with it that will necessitate that. So, yes, she does a bit. I do think of her as sort of West Virginia bound, but she's perpetually, her big struggle is whether she should stay. You know, do you remember the Outsiders, the great S.E. Hinton? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Before it was called, YA was not a genre. Before there was a YA, it was just a great book. There's a character that goes to a fortune teller, a young man, and she looks at his palm and she says, some will go and some will stay. You will stay. And it's a curse to him, you know? And so it's that's always Belle's idea. That's always her great dilemma. Do you go or do you stay? There are places that, you know, no one ever asks you that in Chicago or New York or, but in West Virginia, you're always asked that. Are you one of the ones who leave or one of the ones who are going to stay? So, I mean, your question is really quite profound. Does she leave? Does she have to leave in order to fulfill what she sees as her destiny? In Sorrow Road, the book just before this one, the sheriff has a moment when he thinks, he's always thought of it as kind of a curse to be there in West Virginia and have to stay there. And he thinks to himself that gradually he's come around to thinking that it's a privilege, as he says, to live your life, to live each day on the land that gave rise to you.
God, that's beautiful.
That is lovely.
But you have to live your way into that. You know, if somebody tells you that as a kid, you'd you know, shoo them away. But
mm-hmm. You know, you talked about what people think of West Virginia. I always think of the John Denver song.
Yeah. I know. Yeah.
You know, we have mixed emotions about that song. John Denver was great, and I love John Denver, but a lot of those things mentioned in that song are not actually in West Virginia. They're in Virginia. Oh. And you would be stunned at how many people think that West Virginia is Western Virginia. I have been at events like this with learned people, and they will say to me, oh, you mean Western Virginia. They don't know that there's actually a state called West Virginia.
Really? That's a little sad.
And my question for you, Kent, is I know there's a lot of TV activity surrounding the city Fargo, and I know Kent's gone north and he's gone, you know, east over to Michigan. Yay.
That was a good.
Are you
that was a
Youper?
And he's gone. I went to
She's
college up
here.
There. For
okay.
And of course now south to Arizona. So. Any plans maybe to go to that unique little town and see what's going on over there?
Oh, no, they've already mined Fargo.
Covered, yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
One more question, I think.
Okay. This will be the last question then. Yeah. And then we'll have the book.
He got here first, so he should get to ask a question.
Well, I have to make it a two-part question. for Kent, any possibility you're going to the Tucson book festival this year, or in March?
Yeah, I missed it last year, but I will be back this year.
I missed you last year.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, we winter in Green Valley, which is mentioned in your book.
Yep.
And also one of Ann Hillerman's.
Okay.
Oh. So.
Yeah, you know, for those of you who don't know the Tucson Book Festival, if you are in Arizona the second weekend in March, go to the Tucson Book Festival. It is one of the most vibrant, just exciting book festivals that you can imagine. I go to a lot of book festivals, and it's my favorite. It's my favorite.
Yeah, he says that everywhere, wherever you are. Right? This one's my favorite.
Except for Carytown, okay. Probably.
And
Tarrytown is really my favorite.
See? See?
The second part really may be for both of you. I read with my ears, so. Love audiobooks. I wondered what, how you dealt with the audio productions.
You know, the British publisher of my books, the woman who was going to be doing the reading of it, wrote to me, sent me an email, and wanted to know how to pronounce things like it's Acres Gap. It's not Acres Gap. It's Acres Gap, and various pronunciations. The American reader for the American edition did not. So in Killing in the Hills, she pronounces it. Acres Gap, which is wrong.
Oh, really?
And I listened to it, and I about hit the roof, and just didn't bother to. So then they're much more meticulous for the British. So aside from that little churlish point, I love her voice. I think it's quite wonderful. And by the way, I'll be at the Tucson Book Festival as well this year. So
But it's not a churlish point.
Not really.
Me at the book festival?
No.
Acres Gap. Yeah.
When
yeah, really irritating.
When readers who know the area and know how it, I mean, my current reader, I've had three different audio companies do my books, and the first two asked me how you pronounce the Ojibwe terms, how you pronounce the unusual Minnesota terms, but my current audiobook publisher does not, and my the reader is a great reader, but he gets a lot of it wrong.
Yeah,
because
they just get
bad.
To pronounce, and so I don't listen to my audiobooks
because
it just drives me up a wall.
It's a painful experience.
We have no control over this, by the way, folks. Our audio company chooses our readers. We have nothing to say. But I actually auditioned to read my own work.
I did.
When my books went to a company called Brilliance with Thunder Bay, I said, you know, could I maybe read my own books? Because I'm a pretty good reader. They said, well, sure, come on out. We'll give you an audition. So I went out to, this was in their headquarters are in Grand Haven, Michigan. So I went out to Grand Haven. They put me in this little booth, headphones on, a copy of Thunder Bay in front of me, and they said, okay, begin to read. So I read from the beginning of the novel, and it's mostly expository, and I'm pretty good reading expository stuff. And they said, great, Kent, we have a place marked where there are going to be several voices involved. Could you read from that? So I turned to that section, and I started to read. And then I realized why they have professional people do this. Because my men sounded exactly like my women. My kids sounded like my adults. The thing about a good reader is that this is an artist at work. These are people who can create unique voices and carry them across the whole course of the piece without dropping them. That's talent. That's art.
That is a talent. Well, I want to thank both of you for being here. This was such a great conversation. And thank everyone in the audience for being here, too. And you guys can assign books over there. So if you have another question, you can ask them in line. Thank you very much.
Thanks, folks.